Let's open our Bibles to Acts chapter 27. Many of you might recall the movie The Perfect Storm. It's a very interesting, true movie about the 1991 Northeaster, or the Halloween storm, as many people refer to it. Five sword fishermen who died. Sorry for the spoiler alert. It wasn't an alert, I just told you. But who died in this, what was called the perfect storm. It was the confluence of, I guess it was three different systems, and off the coast of New England. But despite all the technology that was available at the time, they really couldn't see the storm coming until it was too late. And the weathermen didn't pick up on it until it was too late. And even when there was the hint that this could get dangerous, it was the drive for money. And when you understand their lives, you get the picture. But it was the drive for the money that kept them out there. We can beat this. We can do this. I remember after seeing that storm back in the day, I wasn't pastoring back then. And I remember I used to travel to Canada a lot. And one of our employees out of our Toronto office, Alain, was a Newfie. He was from Newfoundland. And he'd been a fisherman in the North Atlantic on one of these large commercial fishing vessels. And I remember speaking to him about the storm, or rather about The Perfect Storm, the movie, and asking him how accurate he thought it was. And he said, oh, it was quite accurate. And he remembered a number of times out in these storms where these boats, large vessels, would go out at least as a pair, sometimes three or four of them. They were always, you know, close enough that they knew where each other was. But he said it was amazing how large these waves would be, that the antennas off of these fishing vessels would go up 75, 80 feet. And that when a swell got between the two boats, you just couldn't see the other boat. You couldn't see its antenna anymore. It'd give you a respect for what that's like. If you've been out, if you enjoy boating, you've probably experienced some foul weather. I enjoy boating, and I've been out fishing. I enjoy it on some larger vessels. I don't have the strongest stomach in the world, but I've been out, done these things, and it's quite. As much as I love the water, it's quite a threatening sense to be out there knowing there are many hundreds of feet of nothing but water below you, and you can't see land, and it's starting to get nasty, and there's not much else you want at that point, at least for land lovers like me, but to get back to shore. So my first experience with that, I think I was probably in fifth grade. And with my dad, it was just the two of us, and I never really thought of it until I got older. You don't need to hear all this. But, as a dad, realizing what my father must have been going through at that time, just needing to get to land. So these perfect storms come in our lives. And, of course, that happens in spiritual terms too, right? Now, obviously, we have the physical, and we're going to read about that today, but there's a spiritual aspect of storms that occur in our lives. Paul, after he's completed his third missionary journey, we read that he goes up to Jerusalem. He's arrested three times in 2 days. I mean, it's a record for Paul. Through a series of events that we've gone over a number of times, he ends up in Caesarea, under protection in Caesarea. Those from the high priest's office and the other priests have come down to make their case against Paul. He's offered the opportunity, first of all, by Governor Felix, but then also by Governor Festus, to make his case in Jerusalem. Paul says, I'm in Caesar's court. There's no way I want to go back there. I've come to Caesar. I want to appeal to Caesar. Festus says, well, into Caesar you'll go. And so we see that Paul has made his case before Felix, before Festus, and now as Herod Agrippa and his wife Bernice, his half-sister, I might add, after they've come, they all recognize that Paul could have been set free had he not appealed to Caesar, but now he's going to be sent to Caesar. That's how we ended chapter 26. We are now going to be entering into chapter 27. I want to reiterate something again. We have these two books, the Gospel of Luke, right? He's not one of the 12, but he was a gospel writer. And so he writes Luke, and then he also writes the book of Acts, or what often I'll refer to as Luke Volume 2, because they really are quite connected. There are many reasons that people may offer as to why Luke wrote this, but I do believe, and it's just my belief, and others believe it too, but it's my belief for a number of reasons, that Luke wrote this for one particular purpose, and that is that these would be the legal documents, Luke, what we call Luke and the book of Acts, that these would be the legal documents that would accompany the Apostle Paul as he goes before Caesar Nero. So, if you think of it that way, when you read through Luke and the Acts of the Apostles, you'll get a better understanding, or you may begin to see, oh yeah, maybe that is really what's going on here. Luke is going to stay with Paul all the way on out through 2 Timothy, which is the last of Paul's writings, written from prison in Rome. He will be released, by the way. He'll make his appeal to Caesar, and Nero will see no reason to hold him. He'll set him free. Tradition says that there's actually a fourth missionary journey. We've been through some of that. I'm not going to go through that again. And it's after that, as Nero is going nuts, it's after he hears the gospel. Apparently, the devil's really working on him. He sends out his emissaries to find Paul, bring him back, puts him back under arrest, and that's when he loses his head in 68 AD. Luke doesn't record any of that for us because Luke has only written this up through when he makes his appeal to Caesar. There's no reason to finish that. It's done as far as he's concerned at that point, and then Paul is set free. So hopefully that may help you in some of these things. Most of you, if you've read through this before, you know that this is the chapter that deals with the great storm on the sea, the shipwreck. And it is, you may also be aware, that in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul talks about everything that he's been through, the difficulties that he's experienced in his ministry. And he includes a listing of 3 shipwrecks. This is not one of them. So there are at least 4 shipwrecks that Paul has experienced. And I find that to be fascinating. He'd actually written to his second letter to the Corinthians 3 years earlier than this. So he departs for Rome from Caesarea when we pick up in August. I just want to give you some scope of this before we dive in. You just can't resist some of the puns. They're just there. He departs from Caesarea for Rome around August of 59 AD. And he's going to arrive in Rome sometime in the spring, April-ish, of 60 AD. So this is a much longer journey than was expected, 2,000-mile trip with a huge detour involved. By the way, we talk about storms. Someone wrote years ago, I don't know who first used it, but every teacher loves to use it. There are different types of storms in our life. Very often we think of a storm, we just think, it's a storm, yikes. But in spiritual terms, recognizing that God is sovereign over all things, then there are storms that have different purposes in our lives. We can think of storms of correction, storms that are designed to bring us back on track again, storms of perfection, storms that are intended to get us more serious in our walk with Jesus Christ and our faith, right? You can come up with all kinds of things that end in action. Storms of correction, storms of perfection, storms of direction, storms of protection. There are storms that God uses to protect us from some other force. Anyhow, but this storm clearly had at least one purpose. And so as we walk through this, Lord willing, we're going to see some of that. So, why don't we try to dive in here? We read this, verse 1. And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. Your King James, I always like the King James for this. He was of the Italian band. It makes it sound like they had an accordion and some other things, and they only played weddings. But in reality, it says the Augustan regiment. In other words, this was like Caesar's special ops guys. Okay, you could consider him a SEAL or a Green Beret. I mean, these are all Roman soldiers were tough dudes. These guys are like the creme de la creme. And so entering a ship of, and I can mispronounce these just as well as the next guy, so bear with me. If you think it can be pronounced better, let me know and I'll let you teach. But so entering a ship of Andromedium, we put to sea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia. Aristarchus, and you might remember his name, so we have the Aristarchus, Luke, and Paul traveling together. Aristarchus, a Macedonian in Thessalonica, was with us. And the next day we landed at Sidon. So basically they've gone up the coast from, I don't have maps here, but most Bibles have maps in them, so you can refer to that. I've also referred you some other resources that are great Bible atlases that you can use, and they're very much worth your while. So in any event, you can track along with Paul's course here. The next day, we landed at Sidon. So they're gone about 75 miles north. And this is interesting to me. Julius treated Paul kindly, and he gave him liberty to go to his friends and to receive care. You know, I think there, for a number of reasons, we've listened to teachers who have characterized Paul in ways that I think are not fair. We do get the sense from the word that Paul was short of stature, had eye problems. He might have, based upon why we think he had those eye problems, he may have had weepy eyes a lot, definitely had problems seeing, so he might have been squinty. One resource I read said he had a kind of an odd-looking nose. I'm trying to stay away from anything that may sound anti-Semitic, but these are just, you know, well-intended descriptions of him. So here's this rabbi, you know, short of stature, kind of a squeaky voice, some say. Anyhow, as we go through that, and we may think sometimes that Paul was kind of crabby. I don't know that he was. He certainly, you know, from a general human standpoint, we could think of reasons that would justify crankiness because of some of the things he'd been through. The respect people had for him is quite interesting. And here is a Roman soldier with this responsibility. And we find out there are 276 souls aboard ship. And here's this Paul, a political prisoner. And the others are probably capital. They've committed capital crimes. So there's another intention for them. But here's a political prisoner. And he hasn't gotten to know Paul that long, but he's probably heard from Festus and some of the other centurions who've been around Paul that not a bad guy. And it's evident as we go through the story. Get on with it, John. I know what you're saying. Already Paul has earned his respect, and he's treated with that regard from Julius. So, I mean, you think about this. Here's a man responsible for all of the prisoners. You lose one, your life is in danger. You'll die for having lost prisoners. So he really trusted Paul to allow him to go and to spend time with his friends in Sidon. And so he did. He found friends there. There's a church there. It's been some time before the Apostle Paul, since the Apostle Paul has had opportunity to worship with other believers in a church setting of any sort. But he keeps his word, obviously. Anyhow, Julius allows him to do that. So we read here that when he had put to sea from there, verse 4, we sailed under the shelter of, or to the lee, to the south of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. Now, it's August. It's going to get dicey beginning in October to November. That's when things get really bad. But anyhow, the winds were contrary, and when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. And there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. So Julius has, you know, a lot of control over this situation. Julius has, he has the responsibility, he has the gold or the credit card, so to speak, because, you know, full faith and credit of the Roman Empire would have been a big deal to anybody who was renting ships or anything of that nature. He's able to get ships as they travel along. He's not able to get a nonstop until this point. He's got a local, right? So they took the local, and now here they are in this port, and he's able to get this other ship. And so when we had sailed slowly for many days, we arrived with difficulty off of Snaeus, the wind not permitting us to proceed. And then we sailed under the shelter of, or to the south of Crete, off Salmone. Some of you are thinking, okay, whatever, it's a map. Well, the map's interesting, because if you watch the direction they're heading here, they're sailing with difficulty because the weather is already starting to pick up. So they've been traveling south of what you and I would call Turkey today, Asia Minor, and now they come to the south of Crete, Salmone, that area. And passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens. That sounds good, doesn't it? Near the city of Lycia. Now, when much time had been spent, now apparently it's late fall by now, so they spent already a good amount of time there, and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul, and now he advises them, let me just stop there, it's not dangerous because the fast, it's that time of year. So it would have been, I think, October 10th or something like that. Either 10th or 5th, doesn't matter to you, right? But it would have been early to mid-October that the fast, in other words, Yom Kippur, would have occurred at that point. And we're going to see that Julius wants to make headway. Others want to make headway. And Paul's going to advise them differently. So he says, men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. Now you're thinking, Paul, now you're a sailor? Well, he's been on a number of ships, but most importantly, as he understands the time of year, as he's praying, he gets the sense this is going to be dangerous, and he says so. And nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman, by the skipper, and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. Now look, the skipper wants to make progress, probably figures we can make it, it'll be fine. And as we learn more about the ship, this is a pretty good-sized vessel. Some people say the displacement was somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 tons, which is a good vessel for that day and age. A sailing vessel, and most of these vessels, more information maybe than you want, but these types of vessels typically had one humongous mast and one very large sail, and that would be its power. The wind would be its power, and they would use rudders. This actually turns out to be a two-rudder ship, and which is a big deal. It's like a double drive-through at Chick-fil-A. Are you hungry now? Go to the one in Horsham. I know the guy. Anyhow, so this is a large vessel. The helmsman, maybe he's thinking, I can do this. I know how to handle this. And the owner of the ship has, we find out, he has a load of grain. They would have taken the grain off the ship from Alexandria. Alexandria was the second largest city in the Roman Empire in those days. And they were famous for a number of things. The library in Alexandria was a huge city, considered an intellectual center. But also, it was the breadbasket. Egypt was the breadbasket for the Roman Empire. So these ships would carry large cargo of grain. So the owner of the ship wants to get paid. Does he really want to wait 4 or 5 months before getting to his destination. When he can get to his destination, get paid, and then maybe wait it out in Rome and then sail back, probably wants that. And the helmsman is probably very sure of himself. None of these guys want to put their lives in danger, but we're not told, and you can only project so far, but I'm assuming that like most of us, it was easier, and why not, right, to believe the experts. I used to know a guy who used to say, all the experts I know are dead. Well, there's something to that, I guess, but it's easier to believe the experts when it comes to a sailing vessel than a 60-year-old, because that's what he is at this point. That's an old man in those days, a 60-year-old Jewish rabbi. And so they listen to these guys instead of Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, or King James, I think, says it wasn't commodious. It may have been fine as far as protecting the ship, but from the sailor standpoint, there's nothing to do there. There's nothing to do there. That's the idea. At least if we're going to winter somewhere, let's at least go someplace that, has a couple bars or a casino, or I don't know, whatever sailors wanted in those days. Probably the same thing they want today. And so they wanted something else, maybe some action for the winter. Because the harbor was not suitable to winter, and the majority advised to set sail from there also, so if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and the northwest, and winter there instead. So that's what they're interested in. So we have we're going to find out, as I think I mentioned, a group of 276 souls altogether. So however many sailors there were, however many soldiers there were, still have a couple hundred easily of these prisoners. And so here you are. They're gonna leave from there and set off for what seems to them to be a reasonable journey. If you're from my generation, you remember there was a TV show that started that way. Just a few people on board. It should have only been a three-hour tour, right? But the weather started getting rough. And we're going to see this huge ship was tossed. And, of course, that's what happened. I don't know what the name of this ship was. It wasn't the Minnow, I don't think. And as we get into this storm and how the ship doesn't fare and all that, what's going through your mind? Because whether you've been in a real storm like this, whether you've been in, we go through all sorts of storms in our lives, we have to keep certain things in view, or we're going to read about anchors that are used. And in most cases here, when you're thinking of anchors, don't think about big iron anchors that go down and hook onto a rock down on the seafloor, but rather sea anchors. If you're familiar with a sea anchor, often shaped, sometimes it's made of some sort of fabric or very, very sturdy fabric, often shaped in a conical fashion. So it has a small hole at one end, large hole at the other, attached with ropes. You'd throw it out from the stern, and the water, as you're moving forward, the water would be caught in the large, right, through the large hole. But it can only go through the back hole so fast. It's called a sea anchor, and it puts drag on the ship. While you're still able to move forward, just not as fast, and you might have a little bit more control over the ship. Nevertheless, in all of that, what's happening here shakes everybody to their innermost man. And what is it that keeps Paul going in this? And you may think, it's his faith in Christ. I have no doubt about that. You may think it's a sense of purpose. It's a peace that he has from God. I'm sure of that. But one thing that he never took his eyes off of, I am absolutely certain about that. We read in chapter 23, verse 11, where the Lord Jesus appears to Paul. Right there in Jerusalem, And he says to him, be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome. Paul knows he's going to Rome. And as I've said before, I mean, if I was hearing that, I'm hearing that, I'm like, great, I'm ready to go to Rome. I've always wanted to go to Rome. This is like the kind of the height of my ministry career. I'm going to go to Rome. I'm going to travel on El Al, because they're a good airline, or Swiss Air, or something like that, and I'll travel first class, probably have the whole section open to me only, and they'll just take care of me. I'll have five-star accommodations when I get there. But of course, it didn't happen that way, did it? And Paul's now headed to Rome. This is where it all begins. And again, if you've always dreamed of a Mediterranean cruise, keep dreaming, and that's good. Maybe you'll get a chance to go on a Mediterranean cruise one day. But as we get into this, please take your Dramamine. As I mentioned earlier, this is one of those situations where the way Luke has recorded this, you can taste the salt in the air. You get this sense of the wind whipping and the waves crashing over this ship. And yet they make it. So we read this, verse 13, when the south wind blew softly. Don't you love that? It sounds like Hawaii, Tahiti, you know, the South Sea Islands. It just, the south wind blew softly. That's so inviting. The storms always start that way, don't they? The south wind blows softly. You gotta say it like Barry White would say it. The south wind blew softly. That's no Barry White. Supposing that they have obtained their desire, they put out to sea and they sailed close by Crete. But there are certain places you don't want to read but, and this is one of them. But not long after that. Yeah, that's what happens. Not long after that. Now remember, there are hundreds of souls on this vessel. 276 we read, but hundreds, more than 200, no doubt, are prisoners. Paul is a political prisoner. And, you know, he's going to go before Nero. And so he's one type of prisoner. But there are other prisoners who have committed capital crimes there. And you have to ask the question as you walk through this, why bother taking these capital prisoners, these ones who've committed capital crimes, why bother bearing the expense of shipping them all the way to Rome? Wouldn't it be easier just to, I mean, Rome was big on crucifixion. Wouldn't it be easier just to crucify them in somewhere, I mean, whether it was in Israel or in Egypt or in, you know, Lebanon area, you know, Tyre and Sidon, those areas, wherever they committed the crimes. After all, Rome's in charge of the whole area, and they do this with prisoners a lot. Why would they be shipped? Don't ever forget the Colosseum. See, in those days, and by the way, this is important, I think, for us to remember. In those days, Rome had gotten to the point where the common man wasn't really able to make that much of a living, not like he had been able to before that. And so the things that the common man cared about was basically, you know, I want to eat and amusement, entertain me. And so the cry of the common people was bread and circuses, feed us and entertain us. And the circuses were prisoners that were thrown to the lions and the other wild animals, prisoners who were tied up in animal skins and then given to the wild dogs. I mean, you know, if you've seen Gladiator, you have a little sense of this. I mean, it was a brutal, brutal time. That's why they borrowed the expense of sending these prisoners to Rome, because they were to entertain the common people. Amusement. You know, the word muse means to think. When you put the prefix a in front of that, it negates. It means not. So amusement in our society, actually, amusement in our nation is an enormous industry. Many, many billions of many, many hundreds of billions of dollars. I guess we're probably in the trillions at this point, that are spent on amusement. Why? To get our minds off the world and just to entertain us. What have we done during this pandemic? Most people, I mean, the joke's always about Netflix and that sort of thing. That's the fact, right? So in any event, that's happening. That's why these prisoners, that's why there's so many of them aboard this ship. Not long after this, south wind blew softly. I love that. It sounds like a song. A tempestuous headwind. This is not just a headwind. This is not a harsh headwind. This is a tempestuous headwind arose, and it was called a Euroclydon. 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 Two words, north and east. It's the Mediterranean version, or I guess the combination of Mediterranean Adriatic seas, but it's their version of what we would call a nor'easter. Bad news, okay? The perfect storm. Anyhow, this Euroclydon arose, basically a hurricane. Not a happy time. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, I mean, they've tried to do everything they could do. They're trying to tack. They're trying to do everything they can do to direct this ship. They couldn't do anything. They could just let it drive. And so that's what they did. And running under the shelter or to the south of an island called Clota, we secured the skiff with difficulty. You know, large vessels like this would carry a small vessel. Often they would just let it trail behind, but now they're trying to secure it, tie it up to the ship so they wouldn't lose it. You would carry the small vessel so that you could anchor the ship offshore and then row in, or in some cases sail, that skiff. That it wasn't like a 12-foot boat. It could have been much larger than that, but no, sorry, they called it a skiff. You don't care. And that's how they would get to land. So, in any event, when they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship, and fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands, they struck sail and so were driven. So, in other words, they if you got into a storm like this, because now they're getting into the open sea with the wind blowing down on them, the tendency was to drive ships the hundreds of miles to the south, right off the course of what we would call Libya today. And those are the Syrtis sands. In other words, sandbars that were further out into the open water, so that if you were driven into one of those, the whole ship would shudder, you'd get jammed up on the sandbar, and the ship would fall apart, basically. So they were going to do everything possible to avoid that. They struck sail. They were driven. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, so that was a tempestuous wind, now they're exceedingly tempest-tossed. I think three times Paul's going to use this term tempest or tempestuous. This is a big deal. The next day, they lightened the ship. What does that mean? They started throwing overboard everything, not the cargo, right? The cargo is money. But everything they can possibly get rid of, any furniture, anything that's not nailed down, including things that were nailed down, getting rid of these things. The higher you can be on that water, higher your chances of survival. And navigation, maneuvering, rather, on the water. And so because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, verse 18, the next day they lightened the ship. On the third day, 3 days. Look, I've been in some storms, and you're there for 4 hours. Or hard water for 5 or 6. And if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. You're saying, where do I go? What do I do? Where you're, I mean, I maybe some of you people have done this where you need to go out. And in my younger days, I would go out on party boats, you know what I mean, where you might have 50 people aboard this vessel and everybody's, you know, fishing for flounder or blues or, you know, whatever the case is off the Jersey coast. And when the weather gets rough, like, you don't know where to go. If you go inside the cabin, there's a lot of people who are, I don't want to get gross, but they're not happy people. They're not happy sailors. And maybe they're losing their lunch or something like that. So you say, if I stay in there, I'm going to be just like them. So you go outside and you can't figure out which place is better for you to be. But 3 days, And that's not the least of it. We threw the tackle overboard with our own hands when neither sun nor stars, can you picture this? Verse 20, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us. In other words, only huge tempests were beating on them. All hope, process that, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. The strongest of all 276 of them had given up. What are we going to do? Neither sun nor stars, he says, for many days. We've gone overnight, we've gone through the second day, gone through the third day, now we're into the many days. We're going to find out this is 2 weeks of this storm. All hope that we would be saved was finally given up. This is hard work, navigating your way through these situations. There's no stars to look at. I mean, the sextant had not been invented yet. I want you, you know, there's no Loran, there's no satellite navigation, there's no sextant, the things you think of that the, you know, the Mayflower captain would have used. They didn't have that stuff. The things Columbus had, they didn't have that stuff. Whatever the Vikings had, I don't know, but it wasn't them. And it wasn't then. They didn't have those things. They had the stars. They knew where Polaris was. They knew what to expect in terms of, you know, some of the major constellations. And you can navigate by those if you can see them. Or by the sun, or for that matter, the moon. They couldn't see any of those things. It's days. You're navigationally blind. You're exhausted, haven't eaten, seasick constantly, no hope of being saved. Verse 21, but after long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them. And he said, men, you should have listened to me. Now, let me finish something. No, I'm just going to say it. There's no way in the world, based upon the way that we really do know the Apostle Paul, that he was pulling the I told you so card. He's not a smart aleck. He's trying to make the point. He's earned their respect in other ways at this point. And because he has, but they didn't listen to him in terms of, you know, the fact they were going to sea when they really should have been more cautious. That's why Paul says, men, you should have listened to me, and you should not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and this loss. But now I urge you to take heart. Take heart means be encouraged. He's telling them all, but I'm urging you, take heart. Be encouraged, for there will be no loss of life. Wow. How do you know that? Well, you know, Paul has said many things to them so far, so he's listening to them. There's not going to be any loss of life, he says, but only of the ship. Yeah, the ship's going to be lost, but no loss of life. How do you know that, Paul? For there stood beside me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. And that angel said to me, don't be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. Acts 23:11. You must go to Rome. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. Therefore, take heart, men. He's talking to every single one of them. For I believe that God... I believe, God, that it will be just as it was told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island. See, there's a purpose in this storm. This is one of those. We're going to find out. I don't know what you think. You know, we have this tendency to read stories like this through the eyes or through the lenses of our own life experiences. So, you know, we have this tendency to think that the whole time you've just been holding on for dear life. But they couldn't eat. They've all lost their lunch. They're exhausted. They're famished. But who wants to even think about eating in a time like that? But 2 weeks, I believe, by now, Paul has made his rounds through every single man on that vessel. And there are some rough dudes who've been there, soldiers included, sailors included, but certainly so many of those criminals, the ones who have committed these capital crimes, there must have been murderers there, insurrectionists. And he says, take heart, for God is going to rescue us, but the ship's not going to be saved through all of this. Now, the 14th night, think about that. 2 weeks from now, the 14th night had come as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea. About midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. You know, they could, one writer talks about how you can, and I've never experienced this, I've only been in ships with motors, but that you can hear breakers, that it's a distinct sound as you're getting close to the land. You can hear the crashing of waves, especially in a storm, on land. Others have talked about how you can smell land. And I imagine that's so. You know, if all you've smelled for weeks has been the ocean air, to now begin to smell soil. So a lot of you know, you may not think about smelling soil, but we do. You can smell soil. You can smell trees. Not just floral things, that's obvious. Flowers have a scent to them. But you can smell land. So they could tell. It's night, so they, you know, they can't see it all, but they know they must be nearing land. So they began to take soundings. And as they did, the first sounding, they found it to be 20 fathoms, or 120 feet. And then when they'd gone a little further, they took soundings again. They found that it's 15 fathoms. So now they've gone from 120 to 90 feet below them. But then, fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. So, yeah, they've used sea anchors up to this point, but now they're dropping real anchors to hold them back, right? They don't want to run into rocks in the nighttime, because their chance would be much better, obviously, when there's light. And so they did that, and as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, did you see that? The sailors now, they're trying to make a run for this. They had let down the skiff into the sea under the pretense of putting out anchors from the prow. They said, oh, yeah, we're just going to make sure the anchors get planted well. We need to take this skiff out. Paul knew what was going on. He could tell. But Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. He's telling them, look, you can try anything you want to, but unless those guys stay with us, none of us are going to survive here. The soldiers will not survive. He's not making a bargain with God. What he's saying is, we need their expertise. They have to operate this vessel, so they need to stay here too. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff and let it fall off. Now you have to depend on God and this vessel alone at this point. And as day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, today is the 14th day. You've waited and continued without food. You've eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you, take nourishment, for this is for your survival. Since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread and he gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. And they were all encouraged. You know, I think it's interesting. I know that when I was a younger believer, sometimes it would, you know, I just say that sometimes it would kind of intimidate me, or maybe you could say embarrass me, to bow my head in a restaurant and pray. I'm past that now. But I know many people go through that, and maybe you feel like that sometimes. Maybe you feel like, you know, I'm in a restaurant. I don't want to be weird or be perceived as weird. Boy, I wish I could remember this guy's name. Maybe it'll come to me before the study's over. But a guy I used to listen to on the radio a lot, and I remember he spoke at a Calvary men's retreat, Calvary Philly men's retreat, many years ago, back in the 90s. And he was talking about, because he taught out at BIOLA, the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. And he was out to lunch at, I don't know, a Denny's or something like that out there in Los Angeles. And he was with a number of professors and pastors and a whole bunch of students. And there were like, you know, 10 of them or something at this big table in the middle of Denny's. And, what's his name? Big man. He must be about 6'4", 5", huge guy. And big voice. And so they're all getting their meals and guys are like getting ready to eat. So he turned to one of the men he was sitting next to and he says, don't you guys pray before you eat? And one of them said, you know, in settings like this, we always want to be careful that we don't give off the vibe that, you know, we're weird or something like that. And David Hocking, that's his name. And Hocking said, okay. He stood up and he shouts out, can I have your attention, please? How would you feel about that one? Especially if you're one of those guys who said, you know, we don't want people to think we're a little strange. Can I have your attention, please? I have here a number of students from the Bible College, and they're a little squeamish about praying in public. So what we're going to do here is I'm going to lead us all in prayer. So would you just stop what you're doing, your conversations, whatever right now, and would you join us as we pray? And he says, our Father in heaven, everybody, they drop their silverware and they put their heads down. It's true. Sorry, I really found it very funny. Prayed through the whole thing. And I don't know whether those guys ever prayed in public again, but that was a lesson. Don't let anybody hold you back. Let me tell you, and I mean that, don't let anybody hold you back. It doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter what they've been through. It doesn't matter if they've committed capital crimes. God is the one. God is the one who cuts through all of that. You get to a point, like they say, there's no atheists in foxholes. You don't find atheists in a shipwreck like this, because you get to a point you're crying out for God. He prayed. He thanked the Lord for the food. No doubt asked for safety, knowing God would keep his word. And you know, sometimes it's right to ask God for things, no question about that. But you know, I've learned in some cases, it's right to just, well, all cases, it's right to thank God for the things his word says about safe travel and things like that. We don't always have to be begging for things that God's already promised. Thank God for his word. Thank God that he always does come through. Okay, so I'm sorry, I got to keep moving here. I shouldn't be taking so much time and going off on these little excursions. But so he prays, they were all encouraged, they took food themselves, and in all we were 276 persons on the ship. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and they threw out the wheat. They have lightened the load, they have thrown out the tackle, right? In other words, all the ropes, all the pulleys, all those things that operate the sail, they've thrown that overboard. Everything that has any kind of weight, they've thrown it overboard. They've thrown out everything. They've saved the cargo for last. I mean, let's face it, the owner of the ship wants to get paid. I don't know what kind of insurance policy he has, but he'll be responsible for this. They threw out the wheat into the sea, and when it was day, they didn't recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach and onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. There's no skiff. Right, they're going to have to run this one way or the other and take their chances. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship. They threw out the wheat. Verse 40. They let go the anchors and left them in the sea. So they cut the ropes of the anchors. Now they're free from anything that would hold them, dependent only on God and the currents. Meanwhile, loosing the rudder ropes and they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, you have two senses of current. Maybe you've seen that. You see that at the Jersey Shore a lot. You know, if you're out at the beaches, you're on a sandbar, basically a big sandbar with a lot of houses. But if you ever look at when the tides go in and out, you see the movement of those waters, the bay water and the ocean water, where those two seas met. They ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. This is huge. I mean, it's, put it in together again. 2 weeks, open sea, wind, waves, you're breathing salt water all the time, you're ingesting salt water all the time. I don't know how they did a freshwater, we're not told, but they sure didn't want to eat, right? And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners. They're like, let's just get rid of them, lest any of them should swim away and escape. And that's the Roman way. Let's just cut our losses. But the centurion, who wanted to save Paul, he knew if he let them go, Paul's in jeopardy too. He wanted to save Paul. So he kept them from their purpose, and he commanded that those who could swim, not a lot of people knew how to swim in those days. Now, Paul apparently knows how to swim. I mean, look, three shipwrecks. My mind goes to, if you haven't learned to swim yet, learn it now. In fact, he even says at one point, he spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've never done anything like that. But that's not a pleasant experience. And I'm sure not a big fan. I think shark movies are interesting. I like catching sharks when I'm fishing, but I can't imagine being in the open sea for a night and a day, especially in warmer waters, knowing that there's sharks all around. So Paul could swim, is my point. And so the centurions would swim, soldiers knew how to swim, that was part of their training, but not a lot of people knew how to swim in those days. So in any event, he commanded that anybody who could swim would jump overboard first and get to land, and the rest, some on boards, and some on parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escape safely to land. So basically, the rest of them who weren't able to swim, they surfed, right? They got themselves some scraps that were coming off the ship as it was broken up, and they used those to float to land. Nah, I'm not going to do that. There's too much here. You know, it's interesting. That's the story as how they get to this place and they find out. And read chapter 28. It's the last chapter. But we'll find out soon that it's Malta where they land. In fact, Luke's writing is so accurate that Bob Cornuke, if you're not familiar with Bob Cornuke, I encourage you to look him up. Bob Cornuke has done a lot of great stuff. One of the things he was involved in early on, back in the late 90s, was finding the real Mount Sinai. He was one of the first guys who got there. And so Cornuke was involved in that. Cornuke was involved with Irwin on the search for Noah's Ark. He's been involved in a number of things so far. But he was very much involved in the search for the anchors from the ship, Paul's ship. Because the description that Luke has given us was so accurate, Cornuke and the guys he worked with were able to find the shore where and roughly where those anchors would have been left. They found a couple of those anchors already. And there's actually a tradition on Malta about Paul and Luke and Aristarchus, etc., being shipwrecked there. Chapter 28 is great. We find out much of the purpose for this storm. One of those was to land at Malta, was to preach the gospel there, for many to be healed. Many miracles were performed, including Publius was the governor of the island, and his father was sick with dysentery, and Paul was able to pray for him, and he was healed. Gospel was preached, and a very early church began there because of that shipwreck. And as we go through that, as you read ahead and as we get there next week, of course, you'll see that they make their way from there up to Syracuse, Regium, up to, do I want to say Puteoli? Anyhow, they finally port in, I think it's Puteoli, and then they make their way to Rome from there. So that'll be good stuff to look at. But if Paul's saying, be encouraged, God has made it clear to me by way of his angel that we're going to make this. He had an audience. These men listened to him. No doubt he had led so many of them to Christ already during that time. And I bet he had a full shipload of, you know, if nothing else, a very large percentage of those men were saved, but a full shipload of men, sailors, soldiers, criminals who were saved, though they may have been thrown to the wild animals in the Colosseum, they ended up, and you're going to meet them someday, they ended up with the Lord in heaven because they trusted Jesus Christ. Paul says, get rid of the lifeboats, cut the lines. We can't depend on those. He says, if you want to survive, you have to stay on board and trust the captain of this ship. One day you're going to look back on your life and you're going to say, what was the purpose of that storm? Some of it you may not understand right now. We've all been through our storms. If you're a brand new believer, maybe you haven't gone through one of these storms yet. You know, often we'll say, Christians are in one of three places at any given point. You're either in a storm right now, or you've just come out of a storm, or you're going into a storm. And that's pretty standard then for the Christian life. But then there are those storms like this, the big Euroclidans, the hurricanes that come from every direction, it seems. What do you do in that situation? What do we hold on to? Or if I could ask, what's your anchor? What's the anchor for your soul? You know, Paul will write in Romans chapter 5. He'll say, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? No, in all these things, we're more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. What are the anchors in your life? What are the anchors you depend on in the storms of life? Your faith has to be one of those. Another one, of course, has to be the purpose of your life. What's the purpose of your life? Jesus Christ, if he's your Lord, you already know something about the purpose for your life. And your life is valuable. And you're not leaving planet Earth until the day. And there's nothing you can do about that. There's nothing you can do about that. Our day is numbered. And when that number comes, that's when we're leaving planet Earth. Do you know God's purpose for you? I remember, was it the Imperials? That's who it was. Sang this song. I want to say it was 1980. He didn't bring us this far to leave us. He didn't teach us to swim, to let us drown. He didn't build his home in us to move away. He didn't lift us up to let us down. No, he didn't. God has a purpose. You may not enjoy what's going on in your life at any given point, but God very much has a purpose for your life. You know, storms come in our lives, and one of the key questions we ask is why? God, why? If you love me, why? Right? We do. We ask that question a lot. I know we do. You know, Paul says this, again, Romans chapter 5. He says here, having been justified by faith, We have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom? Also, we have access by faith into this grace in which we stand, and we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. Not only this, watch this, not only this, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance produces character, and character produces hope, in other words, maturity. And hope does not disappoint us, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit who was given to us. You know, we want to ask why. Why do these things happen in our lives? The son of a wealthy and godly man threw a party. And in the middle of that party, suddenly a great storm blew up in the midst of them, destroyed the house, and all of his brothers and sisters died. That man's father was Job. Job cried out to God. Why? He says, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. But as he looked at his life, this, plus everything else, all the material goods, okay. But all my children? Why? You know, very often we look at the book of Job, we say, what's the theme in the book of Job? And many people will say, well, the theme of Job is, why do the righteous suffer? The book never answers that question. It just doesn't. But it gives us insight into what's going on behind the scenes. It certainly was given to us to illustrate for us how the godly can respond when Satan rises up. Because God allows him to. Jonah was running from God. And you know what happened. Huge storm, probably like a Euroclydon. Probably they just didn't call it that. Out in the Mediterranean. And they got to the point, I'm not going to go through the whole story, we don't have time. You know it, read it again. But in the middle of that storm, he says, I'm the reason for this storm. Throw me overboard, and the storm will end. He wanted to die anyhow. He didn't want to obey God. He didn't want to do what God wanted him to do. And so he was thrown overboard, swallowed by what? A great fish. A fish that was designed to fit him right in his mouth and in his gullet. And then he spit him up on dry land. And he made his way to Nineveh, smelling like fish guts. The disciples were on a stormy sea in the Sea of Galilee. Twice, I may add. And they were fearful of drowning, right? Who wouldn't be? Jesus calmed the sea. Why? So they'd learn to trust him. Why does God allow these things in our lives? I know that I don't always have the answers to these things. And I don't know why God always allows these things. I've asked that question. There are some things I've been able to learn over the years for myself, but I can't always give you the reason for the storm in your life. One thing I do know, God is faithful. And I know that God produces a deeper relationship between us and him through these storms. I just read from Romans 5. You know, it's interesting. We read this in Hebrews 11, the great hall of faith. We read about all the different people, all the different situations that they went through. And the writer goes on to say, and what more shall I say? He's already talked about Noah. He's talked about, well, Enoch and Noah, and he's talked about Abraham and Sarah. And, you know, he goes on and on about all of them, and about Isaac and about Jacob and all this. And then he talks more then about Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and everything. He says, the world was not worthy of them. And your inclination is to say, yeah, but I'm not on that list. Don't be so sure. If you've been washed in the blood of Jesus Christ, the world is not worthy of you. God has a great purpose for your life. And knowing that, and knowing what God has done for us, he says, God, let me read this to you. It's Hebrews chapter 6, beginning in verse 17. God, who determined to show more abundantly to the heirs of the promise the immutability, the unchangeableness of his counsel, has confirmed by oath that by two immutable things, two unchangeable things, in which it's impossible for God to lie. Did you know that? That we might have strong consolation, we who have fled for refuge, to lay hold of the hope set before us. Great hope. And he said, and I love this, and we have this hope as an anchor for our souls. What anchor do you have? The anchor of your faith? Great. It's important, obviously. The anchor of purpose for your life, what God has determined for you already, and that you have a sense you're headed toward. You're in a storm, but you're still headed for that purpose. But we have this hope as an anchor for our souls, sure and steadfast, that enters the presence of God behind the veil, where our forerunner has entered before us, Jesus, our high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. God produces this much deeper relationship. Oh, there's terrible storms. The loss of a child. Storms in a marriage. Financial disaster. The pain and betrayal experienced in a divorce. The erosion of our love and dependence on God as a result of some pain, some physical pain and disease in our lives. Why? Why, God? Why do you do this? And I know that many of us have heard this before, but it's still true. You know the poem, no doubt. Now, I'm not going to recite it here, but you can look it up. About the person with the dream, that God had said, no matter what happens, I'll always walk beside you. He said, but in my dream, Lord, I saw that two sets of footprints in the sand as we walked together. But in the most difficult times of my life, I only saw one set of footprints. How can that be? You promised that you'd never leave me. And of course, you know the rest, right? That's what the Lord said, oh, my child, it was in those times that I carried you. It's cute. It's important, it's true, but it kind of falls into the cute category because we find it on Hallmark cards. Paul says this, writing from Rome, Philippians 1:6. So that I'm confident of this, he says, that he who began this good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. In other words, despite the storms, through the storms, I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you. Or Hebrews 12, verse 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. The storm is only allowed to deepen our walk with him, not to destroy our walk with him, but to deepen our walk. We'll let him. The storm's going to be tough. Who are you going to cling to? And this, I love this. It always astounds me the more I think about it. Paul, at the very end of his life, or nearing the end of his first imprisonment in Rome, 2 Timothy 2:13. He says, if we are faithless, then God remains faithful.